Supreme Court allowed the Trump administration to resume immigration raids in the Los Angeles area.
They had been blocked by a lower court judge who said the operations targeted people based on race.
For Monday, September 8th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The massive tax and spending bill that President Trump signed into law this summer included changes to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program.
But the Department of Agriculture has only just started to issue guidance.
They've had almost no time to prepare for the work requirement, and many don't even know about it.
Also, two more than a century-old shipwrecks have been found at the bottom of Lake Huron and Lake Michigan.
Why more and more of these time capsules are being found lately?
It's the little stories that are associated with it. It tells us about shipboard life.
That's ahead, First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The Department of Homeland Security is launching a federal immigration operation in Illinois. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports President Trump has repeatedly threatened to send National Guard troops as well as immigration and customs enforcement officers into Chicago.
DHS is calling it Operation Midway Blitz, saying it's in honor of a woman killed by a drunk driver who was an unauthorized immigrant in Illinois. NPR confirmed that crash took place this year in Urbana. The driver was a Guatemalan national and is facing charges, including DUI and reckless homicide. DHS says the operation will target, quote, criminal illegal aliens who flocked to Chicago and Illinois, saying that they went there because they knew Illinois Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker's sanctuary policies will protect them. The announcement comes as the U.S. Supreme Court allowed the Trump administration to resume immigration raids in Los Angeles after a lower court judge had blocked them. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Chicago.
After a New York doctor prescribed abortion pills to a patient in Texas, Texas sued the doctor. And now New York's attorney general is getting involved. NPR's Ava Pukach reports the state's rights case is likely to end up before the Supreme Court.
Abortion shield laws like New York's protect providers prescribing abortion pills to patients in states that ban abortion. Last week, Texas lawmakers passed a bill allowing citizens to sue anyone who prescribes abortion medication to Texas residents for $100,000. New York Attorney General Letitia James blasted the lawsuit by her Texas counterpart.
Now, I find it ironic that the state of Texas would impose their beliefs upon residents here in the state of New York. It's a woman's right to choose.
Some Democratic-led states are strengthening their shield laws. California lawmakers are working on a bill allowing abortion pills to be sent without the name of a patient, prescriber, or pharmacist. Ava Pukach, NPR News.
Pfizer and BioNTech have released new data showing their latest vaccine for COVID-19 remains safe and effective against new variants. NPR's Rob Stein reports.
The companies say a study involving 100 people shows the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine triggers a strong immune response to the variant targeted by the reformulated vaccine. That variant is among the closely related strains that are currently dominant in the U.S. Pfizer and Moderna have been releasing additional information about their vaccine since President Trump called for more data about the shots, and comes as many people are having a harder time getting vaccinated because of new federal restrictions on who's eligible. Rob Stein, NPR News.
Stocks traded higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 114 points at the close. The Nasdaq Composite up 98. This is NPR News. In Washington. Videos made by artificial intelligence are being used to animate the Bible. As NPR's Jeff Brumfield reports, one company is hoping to grab followers, but theologians are concerned.
It's called the AI Bible, and it tells Bible stories through machine-generated videos, like this one about the prophet Elijah.
You'll get your showdown. Prophet.
The videos made by AI tools often resemble something out of a fantasy action movie. Max Bard is with the company Pray.com, which makes the videos. He says that's kind of the point.
Think of, like, if we were the Marvel universe of faith.
The videos are getting millions of views online, but critics worry they're devoid of spiritual meaning. Brad East is with Christian Abilene University in Texas.
It actually felt like a bad video game.
East says these AI videos rob the Bible of its power. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
The FDA is giving the green light to Mass General Brigham in Boston and Cambridge-based eGenesis for nationwide clinical trials to test the use of pig kidneys in human transplants. Surgeons at Mass General Hospital first successfully transplanted the genetically engineered pig organ into a human patient more than a year ago. The new approval will allow them to expand the procedure for trial at transplant centers around the country. Recapping stocks on Wall Street today, the Dow up 114 points, the Nasdaq Composite up 98, the S&P also traded higher, up 13 points. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
It is 4:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com. Looking at weather tonight, showers likely, lows 55 to 60, patchy fog after midnight.
Says All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. We begin this hour in Washington, where today the U.S. Supreme Court cleared the way for the Trump administration to resume ethnic profiling tactics in rounding up undocumented immigrants for deportation. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg has been following this closely. She's with me now. Hey, Nina.
Hi there.
Tell me a bit more about the Supreme Court order today.
Well, this was another unsigned Supreme Court order delivered without explanation on the emergency docket. The Trump administration asked the justices to block a lower court decision that barred ICE and other federal agents from rounding up immigrants based in large part on what the federal district court judge called blatant racial profiling, that's a quote. The federal appeals court declined to block that decision while it considers the case, and so the administration then went to the Supreme Court, which agreed to intervene. This marks an astonishing 24th time in less than 8 months that the administration has gone to the Supreme Court to override temporary lower court orders, and in 21 of those cases, the court has given the administration what it wants. These just are numbers that are simply unheard of in the history of the court.
Well, and in this particular case, what exactly had the lower court, the district court judge, concluded in her ruling?
She said that there was a mountain of evidence that people were being rounded up by teams of masked and armed agents who arrest and detain people based on their brown skin, foreign accents, or the places they work, like car washes and landscaping companies. Some of the people, including American citizens who were caught up in these sweeps, challenged these practices in court. One of them, for instance, was a U.S. citizen born in Los Angeles who was stopped while working on his car outside his home. The incident was captured on video, showing the agent slamming the guy up against a metal gate and other agents twisting the guy's arm and grabbing his phone. The judge found that this kind of conduct was a clear violation of the Constitution's ban on search and seizures of individuals without any prior justifying evidence.
Okay, so that's the background. That is what the Supreme Court has waded into. And what exactly did the court's conservatives do?
Well, without explanation, they allowed the government to reinstate its practices, at least for now. One justice, Brett Kavanaugh, wrote a concurring opinion seeking to explain the court's, or at least his, justification. Particularly in this case, he said, given the millions of individuals illegally in the United States, the interests of the individuals who are illegally in the country in avoiding being stopped for questioning is ultimately an interest in evading the law. That's not an especially weighty legal interest, he wrote. Justice Sonia Sotomayor, writing for the court's three liberal justices, blasted Kavanaugh and the court's other conservatives for parachuting into the case at an early stage. Calling the court's action another grave misuse of the emergency docket, Sotomayor said, "We should not have to live in a country where the government can seize anyone who looks Latino, speaks Spanish, and appears to work at a low wage job."
Huh. Let me briefly move you, Nina, onto another action taken today. This was by the Chief Justice, John Roberts. He is temporarily barring lower courts from reinstating the last remaining Democratic member of the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission. Where are we on this one?
This is only a so-called administrative say, a pause to allow time for the other side to file briefs, but it's yet another strong indication that the court's conservatives are aiming to reverse a nearly century-old decision barring presidents from firing independent agency commissioners, except for misconduct.
Okay.
And if the administration prevails in this case, take a look at RFK Jr. and his firings of medical experts as a forecast of things to come.
And NPR's Nina Totenberg, thanks.
Thank you.
Now to France and a vote today in Parliament.
194 contre 364.
That is the sound of French Prime Minister François Bayrou losing a confidence vote after just 9 months in office. The far left and extreme right joined other opposition parties to stop his plans to cut the budget deficit. French President Emmanuel Macron must now name a new prime minister. NPR's Paris correspondent Eleanor Beardsley is here with more. Hi.
Hi, Juana.
Eleanor, tell us what happened today in the French National Assembly.
Well, I want to start by letting you hear 74-year-old centrist Prime Minister François Bayrou speaking tonight before the vote. He's respected and has had a long political career, though he'll be resigning tomorrow. Here he is.
J'ai voulu ce rendez-vous, et certains d'entre vous, les plus nombreux,
he said, I wanted this confidence vote, and many of you told me it was risky. But I thought the opposite. I thought continuing on with politics as usual until we reached the edge of the cliff was risky. You see, France has massive debt, 114% of GDP, currently the highest in the Eurozone. And Bayrou has been on a crusade to alert the French to what he calls this Damocles sword hanging over the country. And he wanted the support of the parliament as he tried to enact huge cuts in the next budget. But he didn't get it.
So, Eleanor, what comes next?
Well, tomorrow morning, Bayrou will present his resignation to President Macron, who will have to go back to the drawing board to name a new prime minister. But each time Macron has to do this, it gets harder. Bayrou was Macron's third prime minister in the last year and a half. This revolving door of prime ministers began last year when Macron gambled and dissolved parliament, hoping to increase his majority. Instead, he lost his majority. The far right and the far left now control the biggest blocks in parliament. They are demanding that the new prime minister come from their camp. So Macron will have a very difficult time getting and naming a centrist to implement his policies. I spoke with French political journalist Thierry Arnaud about it.
It is a disastrous situation for President Macron, who now has only bad solutions ahead of him. Macron will try to do everything he can to avoid putting the far right in charge of the government, but it's not necessarily obvious that he will have that option.
Eleanor, any sense who the next prime minister might be?
Right now, no one knows, but the far left and far right really want the job, and they're thrilled with tonight's vote. Here is far left France Unbowed Party Congresswoman Mathilde Panot speaking. She says, this vote signifies that Macron's policies by the rich and for the rich and his social war against the people is over. You know, her party says France has no debt problem. And they've also called on Macron to resign along with his prime minister. They say he's illegitimate. Of course, there's little chance that would happen. Macron has two more years to go. But his support is very low. It's around 15%, Juana. Mm. And the far-right National Rally Party, the most popular party in France right now, is polling at about a third of the electorate, is pushing its candidate, 29-year-old Jordan Bardella, who's the far right-hand man of Marine Le Pen, whose family has run the party for more than 50 years after her father founded it. He's a TikTok star, popular with young voters, and says he's ready to be prime minister. But for sure, a far-left or far-right government would take France in a very different direction than the way Macron's been leading it. Macron says he'll name a replacement in the coming days, and we wait.
We wait indeed. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley, thanks.
Thank you, Juana.
Here in D.C., it is starting to feel like fall outside, which means if it's fall, it's apple season. But which apple? Honeycrisp, Granny Smith, Red Delicious, you know, the classic. Well, if you have ever wondered this, there is a website you should visit. It is called applerankings.com. Now, this started as a joke. It has blossomed into something of an essential guide for apple lovers. Comedian Brian Frangi runs the website. Brian, welcome. Happy apple season to you.
Yes, happy apple season. It's the most wonderful time of the year. I know a lot of people say the holiday season is the most wonderful time of the year, but those people are wrong. It's apple season.
So, okay, talk me through the rankings. You rank them on a scale of 1 to 100, which starts with, I guess, the lowest batch would be apple hell, including, give me some of the subcategories there.
Many apples fall into the horse food category, which are apples that are not meant for human consumption. And it goes all the way up to the immaculate apple, which I have yet to discover.
How seriously do you take all this? I did introduce you as a comedian.
Yes, I take this with the utmost of seriousness. This is my life's work. Most people don't know me as a comedian. Most people don't know me. But if they do know me, they know me as a person who ranks apples. And I've made it my life's purpose to find every single apple variety that exists on this planet, taste it, and rank it. And I think that's a good enough life to live. I mean, what else is there?
I love it. What is your most controversial pick?
Currently on my website, the Macintosh apple is ranked 50 out of 100. And in my comments section, you might see a ton of people telling me I'm wrong. This puts my entire ranking system into question, that I should be ashamed of myself. And, you know, on the rare occasion, I get an email threatening bodily harm. And so I decided every year I'm going to find a Macintosh apple and try it. And this year, I literally went to an orchard during peak Macintosh season, and I asked a farmer to give me their best Macintosh apples. And this farmer assured me these are the ripest, these are the best Macintoshes you can find. And I tried it. And the end result is I am going to lower the score. It was worse than I remembered.
Let me end by asking, which apples do you actually like? What's your favorite?
Well, for many years, my number one apple was the Sweet Tango apple. But I do have a fear that, and this is the first time I'm ever saying this out loud, publicly, I am a little concerned about the quality and future of the Sweet Tango apple. I truly hope that the quality remains, but there have been several inconsistent seasons. And it worries me because I have it ranked number one and my reputation stands behind the quality of this apple. And when a consumer tries a Sweet Tango and it's not quite as good as I made it out to be, then my entire life's legacy is undermined.
Well, I will join you in sending hopes and love to the Sweet Tango and hope that that is not your fate. Brian, thanks so much for talking us through it.
My pleasure.
Brian Frangi, he's creator and curator of applerankings.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is your Daily Dose of Phenology, where John Latimer looks back at his nature notes from this date. Donating stocks and mutual funds is a quick, easy way to defend KXE from funding cuts. You may receive tax benefits as well. Call Sarah for details at 218-326-1234.
On today's date, September 8th, 1998, I admire the bluebirds sitting on the power lines. Bluebirds are always an exciting bird to see in the springtime. They have a lovely song. They come back to their homes, the nest boxes that we've put out. They check out the boxes. They squabble over who's going to settle where. They won't allow other bluebirds to live right next door, but they'll put up with the tree swallows so they can share these boxes. The bluebirds, once they've hatched their family, sort of disappear from the area. I don't see them very often during the later part of the summer. Oh, here and there, I might spot one or two. But this time of year, the bluebirds begin to congregate on the power lines. If they are a family group, they certainly don't display it on the power lines because they never sit next to one another. There's always, there may be on one may be on an upper line, one may be on a lower line, slightly removed. If they're on the same line, they'll be 5, 10, 15, 20 feet apart. They just keep to themselves, but they still present a beautiful blue and orange backdrop to the colors that are starting to intensify.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Visit St. Pete Clearwater, Florida, where white sand beaches meet the arts, from the Dalí Museum to more than 500 public murals. More at visitspc.com. From Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
In the last several months, two more than a century old shipwrecks were discovered in the Great Lakes. The SS James Carruthers in Lake Huron, one of the largest missing ships in the region, and the Frank D. Barker in Lake Michigan. There are two in a record number of shipwrecks that have been found in North America's giant freshwater lakes in recent years. To find out why these discoveries are happening so frequently nowadays, we called up maritime archaeologist Tamara Thompson. Tamara, welcome to All Things Considered.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Okay, so just to get us started, it is estimated that there are more than 6,000 shipwrecks in the Great Lakes. How drastic is the increase of their discoveries in these past 2 years?
Oh my goodness, it's been accelerating. So we have a lot more shipwrecks that are being discovered every single year. I've worked this job for 22 years, and it used to be that we would have one or two, maybe three on a good year that was reported. But in our record years, we've had 17, 18, 25 shipwrecks reported, and it's a struggle to keep up.
What can you tell us about what caused the spike?
Well, it's a number of factors. So first of all, increased press and awareness. We also have a lot of efforts that have been put forth by state and federal agencies. So I work for state government, Wisconsin Historical Society, but there are the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration in recent years has established three federally designated sanctuaries. So public awareness is at a peak about these resources, and they're very visually appealing. The water has cleared up since invasive species have come into the Great Lakes, zebra and then quagga mussels. So where it was that the water was maybe about 10-foot visibility, now on a bad day, you're seeing 100-foot visibility. So the ability to see down through the water and to notice a shipwreck that you're paddling over, especially in these shallow situations, has increased. But also accessibility to technology. So it used to be that fish finders just could see the bottom, and they didn't have the capability of side scanning. And now almost every boat that you get will have some sort of side scan sonar ability on it and the ability to recognize submerged structure on the bottom. So we're getting a lot of reports of these shipwrecks from fishermen as well.
What can you tell us about the impact that climate change has played and what researchers and people have been able to find?
Well, we're seeing that there's an increase in storms, and also those storms that are hitting our shores are in increased intensity. So we see a lot of sand movement, especially here along the Wisconsin coastline. And so that exposes shipwrecks that are buried on our beaches or in shallow water as these giant waves come and crash and wash out the sand.
What can you learn from each new discovery? What can it teach us?
Oh my goodness. So each one of these shipwrecks is really a time capsule. They represent this point in time when a ship went down. It may have been carrying a particular cargo. It tells us about shipboard life. what the crew would have carried with them and what went down with the ship. And in some cases, these are burial sites. So this is the last place that men and sometimes women were working on these vessels, and they unfortunately lost their lives. So we have to be very respectful of these places. And in Wisconsin, we treat them as archaeological sites, so they're protected under the law from looting and damage, and given in some cases protection under our burial laws as well.
Tamara, I wonder, it sounds like you're so passionate about this. What is one thing you would want us to know about these sorts of discoveries that maybe wouldn't be evident for folks who don't follow them as closely as you do?
Oh, they sometimes have the most interesting and rich histories. So it may be the scene of a disaster, and on face value, you see when it went down and what it was carrying and if there was human life lost. But it's the little stories that are associated with it. If there was a dog that was on board, and how they rescued the dog, these type of little Easter eggs that are throughout the history that we get to unravel when we're doing this work.
Tamara Thompson is a maritime archaeologist at the Wisconsin Historical Society. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Nearly 42 million people rely on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, to put food on the table. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, which is in charge of SNAP, has only just started to issue guidance on how states should implement new work requirements for people to receive these benefits. NPR's Maria Godoy reports.
The changes to SNAP were included in the massive spending and tax bill President Trump signed into law this summer. Under the new rules, most able-bodied adults without dependents must now prove they work, volunteer, or take part in a training program for at least 80 hours a month in order to keep their benefits. Previously, people age 55 and up were exempt from meeting the work requirements. Under the new rules, people aren't exempt until age 65, says Ed Bolin with the left-leaning Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
So older unemployed adults who may struggle to find work because they've lost their job in their early 60s, it could be hard to find a new one.
And parents of children age 14 and up will now be required to work to keep their benefits. People who don't meet the work requirements will only be able to receive SNAP benefits for 3 months in a 3-year period.
There are estimates that about 2.4 million people would lose benefits under these time limit related changes that the new law requires.
Bolin says most people who receive SNAP do want to work, but it might take more than 3 months to find a job. Angela Rashidi is with the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank. She says with unemployment still relatively low, 3 months should be appropriate time to find work.
The overarching goal of the policy is to ensure that there's an expectation for work or a path towards work for those who are seeking government benefits.
But a 2021 study by the Urban Institute found that limiting how long people can receive SNAP benefits does not lead to more people getting jobs, but it does lead to more people losing food aid. Late last week, the USDA's Food and Nutrition Service started putting out guidelines on how to implement the new rules. A USDA spokesperson told NPR states have until November 1st to adopt the changes to SNAP. But details on just how to do that are still scarce, says Louise Hayes. She's an attorney at Community Legal Services who helps clients access SNAP benefits in Philadelphia. The city has been wrestling with implementing work requirements.
Many of our clients are very confused and alarmed by the new work requirements because they've had almost no time to prepare for the work requirement, and many don't even know about it.
And she worries people will lose benefits because of changing and additional paperwork requirements. The USDA says it will roll out more details by the end of the month. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It is 429, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. Programming is supported by the Bush Foundation, accepting application for the 2026 Bush Fellowship, September 2nd through noon on October 7th. The Bush Fellowship invests in leaders and their capacity to do more good. Up to 30 leaders receive $150,000 to support their leadership plan. Visit bushfoundation.org. The History of Jazz airs Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4 with host Paul Kibbe, exploring the distinctly American art form. Hear more Jazz Sundays at 6 p.m. with volunteer-hosted Jazz on America Avenue. Stages of the Range players hold auditions for the ice fishing play today and tomorrow from 4:30 to 6:30 at Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Virginia. The play was written by Minnesota storyteller Kevin Kling, and performance dates are in November.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In Alaska, there are a growing number of cases involving young teens in small remote indigenous communities who are sexually exploited online. As KNBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, the FBI believes one North Slope man who was indicted this summer could have other victims.
After FBI investigators arrested Robert Segovin and Wainwright this July for child exploitation, they wanted to be sure the North Slope man didn't have any other victims. In charging documents, they showed evidence of how Segovin, who is 31, used social media chats to badger teenage girls into sending him sexually explicit pictures of themselves. The victims were as young as 12, 13, and 15. Chloe Martin, a spokesperson for the FBI's Alaska field office, says, although this case takes place in one of the most isolated places in the nation, it is not beyond the FBI's reach.
No matter where a child lives, they deserve safety, support, and justice.
Martin says sexual exploitation occurs in large cities and small communities alike, and it helps to end the abuse when victims come forward.
Victims may be eligible for certain services, potentially restitution, and rights under federal and or state law. And of course, all identities of these victims will be kept confidential.
The FBI's Anchorage field office and the North Slope Borough's police department worked together on this case, which came to light last October after a North Slope Borough police officer took a complaint from a 15-year-old girl. She told the officer Segovin had asked for images of her breasts and private parts. In the course of the investigation, he learned that other children had received similar messages and that a 13-year-old had sent Segovin nude photos. The FBI is asking anyone who has information about Segovin's alleged crimes to contact the Anchorage FBI field office or go online at tips.fbi.gov. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Hundreds of First Nations chiefs recently gathered in Winnipeg for their annual meeting. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, most of the talk was about the impact on their communities of new laws allowing the fast-tracking of major infrastructure projects.
The concerns brought to the Winnipeg meeting focused on how First Nations rights were being challenged by the push by Ottawa to have major projects moved forward. Many chiefs are angry that the new law, Bill C-5, was pushed through with only 7 days to review and comment on it. Cindy Woodhouse-Nepinak is the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations.
The way the act was introduced has caused concern for many chiefs. This assembly is an opportunity for chiefs to deliberate and to provide direction moving forward.
But 2 days into the gathering, the chiefs voted down a pitch to include First Nations infrastructure ventures in the government's national plan to fast-track major projects like pipelines and mining of precious metals. The resolutions didn't get the needed 60% support. Some said passing the resolution would have been supporting the federal legislation and could have put their rights in jeopardy. The vice chief of the Federation of Sovereign Indigenous Nations said major project discussions must include Indigenous people because these decisions affect treaty rights by impacting their ability to exercise rights to hunt, fish, trap, and pass on their way of life. More than 600 chiefs from across the country attended the meeting. Other issues on the table included talks on child welfare reform, native policing, health care, the drug crisis, and the lack of proper housing on reserves. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Drummond Woodsum, a full-service law firm whose nationally recognized tribal nations practice provides services to tribal nations and their enterprises and to companies that do business with tribes across the country. More at dwmlaw.com. Skuktash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods, tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Om Nye.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Subaru Outback with standard symmetrical all-wheel drive and up to 9.5 inches of ground clearance. Learn more at Subaru.com/Outback. From Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. The trial of Ryan Ruth, the man charged with trying to assassinate Donald Trump last year when he was running for president, began today in Florida. This was allegedly the second attempt on Trump's life during that campaign. It took place while Trump was golfing at his West Palm Beach club in September. Now, Ruth is not an attorney, but is representing himself in the trial. Jury selection got underway today. NPR's Greg Allen was there, joins us now from Fort Pierce, Florida. Hi.
Hi, Juana.
Greg, start by just telling us, what is Ryan Ruth being charged with?
Well, you know, this is this case that began in September of last year when Donald Trump was running for president, as you say. A Secret Service agent who was part of his security detail says he saw a gun poking from the tree line a few holes ahead of where Trump was golfing. The agent then fired on the person holding the gun. A witness says he saw Ruth flee the scene, and Ruth was arrested a short time later. He faces five charges, including attempting to assassinate a presidential candidate, and he's pleaded not guilty. If convicted, he faces a possible maximum penalty of life in prison.
Tell us what happened in court today.
Well, this was the first day of jury selection. We had a large pool that's been called for this trial, nearly 200 people. They're being screened to select a 16-member jury. It's going to be a lengthy process, it's one that Ryan Ruth will be directly involved in. As you mentioned, he's representing himself in the trial, and as part of that, he submitted a list of questions that he wants to ask jurors in the screening process.
Greg, how is he doing as his own defense counsel?
Well, you know, at today's court session, he appeared in a gray suit, khaki pants, red striped tie. His ankles appeared to be shackled, but it was the first time that he's shown up in court not wearing prison garb. U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon is giving him a lot of leeway as he exercises his constitutional right to defend himself. Today, she told him, though, she had problems with some of the questions he wants to ask jurors in the screening process. The federal prosecution team has objected, actually, to all of them. Judge Cannon said today that he wants to ask jurors questions about their attitudes toward Palestine and a proposal that the U.S. purchase Greenland. Those are, in her words, politically charged questions that will not be allowed. She describes some other questions he wants to ask as diffuse. One he wants to ask jurors is, if you saw a turtle in the road, would you stop and move it? Prosecutors said that seemed to be aimed at finding jurors who'd be open to an argument that an attack on the presidential candidate was justified, and Ruth ultimately agreed to withdraw that question.
Okay, got it. Now, it sounds like he's taking a sort of unusual approach to jury selection, but any sense of how he might defend himself?
Well, many of those on his witness list are friends and co-workers, people who are being called to testify about his character. Another clue may be that he wants to submit as evidence the full text of a 12-page letter he left with a friend that was turned over to authorities after his arrest. This is that letter that begins, quote, "Dear world, this was an assassination attempt on Donald Trump, but I failed you." Now, prosecutors wanted to show just the first page to the jury. Ruth told Judge Cannon he wants to show the whole letter because, quote, "Every line is about gentleness, peacefulness, and nonviolent caring for humanity." And Judge Cannon says she'll wait until later to rule on that request.
Greg, what else can you tell us about evidence in this trial?
Well, a key piece of evidence, I think, will be the SKS-style rifle that was left behind in what prosecutors say was a sniper's nest near the golf course in West Palm Beach. It hadn't been fired that day, and had a scope attached to it in a makeshift manner, kind of using electrical tape. Before they were dismissed, Ruth's lawyers were planning to question how well or whether it would have worked if it fired at Trump that day. It's not clear now what Ruth is going to do with that, but he is going to call as one of his witnesses a former Marine sniper instructor. Prosecutors say there's no question the gun worked. They say the question of how well it worked isn't relevant. More importantly, they say, is Ruth's alleged intent to use it to try to kill presidential candidate Donald Trump. And if there's poor planning, they say that shouldn't be used as a defense.
NPR's Greg Allen in Fort Pierce, Florida. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
The fate of Rupert Murdoch's media empire appears to be sealed. Murdoch is the controlling owner of Fox News, also the Wall Street Journal, and dozens of other media properties. And he has just settled the legal fight with three of his children over who would control his companies after his death. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik has covered this battle. He's here with details. Hi, David.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Hey, so this has been the family fight to end all family fights. What were the stakes?
Well, this involves the control of those properties that you mentioned, Fox and Wall Street Journal, perhaps Paramount among others, but dozens of other media properties. Who will run them as business enterprise? Who will control them and their ideological and political direction? And, you know, Murdoch had created a family trust after his second divorce, essentially to stave off having to give half of his holdings to his second wife when he divorced her, Anna Torv Murdoch, and to say, okay, all four of my children, when they become adults, will share in this equally financially. He later added on his two children financially, but not the same corporate control in that trust after he married a third time. And then he wanted to undo this in a probate court in Nevada, and probate officials there indicated they weren't buying it.
So who won? Who's going to run the companies?
Well, his desired heir was his older of the two sons, Lachlan Murdoch, somebody really cast in his own image, looks a lot like Rupert Murdoch, has some of the bravado and certainly definitely the ideological leanings. But he had sort of pitched his two boys against each other in competition throughout their entire adult life, and really ignored people like Prudence Murdoch, his eldest child, who really didn't have the same interest, and Elizabeth Murdoch, a media executive of some real renown and accomplishment, because they were female. Right now, what's happening is that the family trust is going to buy out James Murdoch, Elizabeth Murdoch, and Prudence, and they're going to issue a ton of new shares to create a new family trust, which will effectively dilute the control that Lachlan has from what his father had after his father dies, and yet still allow Lachlan to hold on to control the company effectively.
So nobody's going to run it quite the way Rupert Murdoch has run it. Taking the family drama, the family intrigue out of this, David, what does it mean for these media companies, for the media empire that Rupert Murdoch built?
Well, in the words of Donald Trump, there's no one like Rupert, right? Rupert Murdoch has been a singular presence. He's built up this extraordinary global international company from a single newspaper that he inherited from his father in Adelaide on the southern coast of Australia. And he's done it with bravado. He's done it with, at times, recklessness. He's done it with cunning. He's done it knowing when to push forward sometimes and when to have to retreat. And there's a real question. Does Lachlan Murdoch have those same instincts? Is he going to be a good manager, or can he be a bit of a bold leader as well at a time of incredible change in the media world? At the same time, what Rupert and Lachlan have been trying to sell to investors, as well as to the court in the case that has now been wrapped up and settled, is that there's a need for stability, and that Lachlan Murdoch could provide that, most keenly in the question of the ideology that Fox News in some ways presents, the perhaps the most important financial part of their empire. It is, of course, gone hard right in the Trump era. And James Murdoch has, over the years, become increasingly uncomfortable, increasingly publicly vocal about whether or not this is the right direction, both from a business and a moral perspective. And he's been joined to some extent by his two sisters, Elizabeth and Prudence. And yet now, we now know there is stability. We now know where Fox News is headed after Rupert Murdoch, currently 94 years old, passes on. And so we have clarity, at least for the first time in years, as to what's going to happen.
Going to be really, really interesting to see what changes and what doesn't at The Wall Street Journal, Fox News, and all the others. NPR's David Folkenflik, thanks so much.
You bet.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are tuned in to All Things Considered this Monday afternoon here on member-supported KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is North Star Stories. Support comes from Edge Center for the Arts in Big Fork, presenting Mil E Tichy, New Music from the Old Country. Sam Miltich and his friends will take the stage on Saturday, September 13th at 7 p.m. Tickets available at the door, info at edgecenterarts.org. The Minnesota Department of Transportation has an open house Wednesday, September 10th at 5:30 about the Grand Rapids La Prairie Corridor Study. Meet at Yanmar Arena for a brief presentation, followed by an opportunity for questions and feedback. The Virginia Public Library offers a genealogy assistance program the second Thursday of the month at 4 p.m. Whether you're just starting out or fine-tuning your research, all are welcome. Now it's time for North Star Stories here on KAXE KBXE.
This is North Star Stories, voices from where we live. Today in Minnesota,
the viral video of a woman making racial slurs has resulted in even more criminal charges. Then state leaders face questions after the latest mass shooting. And Minnesota blood banks need your donations. I'm Gracie J. Well, a brother and sister in Rochester now face criminal charges accused of fraudulently claiming money intended for the family impacted by a racist incident earlier this year. In May, a video of a woman yelling racial slurs at a young child at a Rochester park went viral. The NAACP raised more than $300,000 for the victim. A brother and sister falsely claim to be the impacted family. The NAACP confirms no funds were distributed to the siblings now accused of fraud. Meanwhile, the woman accused of making the racist slurs now faces charges of disorderly conduct. Next, after the shooting at Annunciation Catholic School in Minneapolis, state leaders are facing new pressure to act on gun violence. But the path forward is far from clear. Zan Holston has more.
Two children dead, 18 injured, in a community reeling from a shooting on the first day of school. But while people try to make sense of what happened, Minnesota's gun control debate has been reignited.
We need a statewide and a federal ban on assault weapons.
Flanked by members of Moms Demand Action, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey called for major changes to state and federal gun laws. He also pressed for a ban on high-capacity magazines.
There is no reason that someone should be able to reel off 30 shots before they even have to reload.
According to Every Town for Gun Safety, a national group that tracks gun laws and advocates for restrictions, 10 other states have already banned both assault rifles and high-capacity magazines. With the renewed pressure for action, Governor Tim Walz is planning a special legislative session to discuss a gun control package he said won't infringe on Second Amendment rights. But any new gun legislation faces hurdles. Democrats have a one-seat majority in the Senate, while Republicans hold an extra seat in the House.
We don't see any progress on gun violence prevention when there is anything other than a Democratic majority in the state.
Maggie Emery is executive director of Protect Minnesota, a coalition working to prevent gun violence. She says the problem is one of political will.
Not because gun violence is or should be a partisan issue, but because our parties truly cannot work together to get this done.
Emery says gridlock can't be an excuse any longer and argues lawmakers need to act before another community is forced to confront the same kind of tragedy.
It's Minnesota's turn today, but it will be somewhere else's turn tomorrow. This will keep happening until our legislators have the political courage to stand up to the gun lobby and to do what's right to protect children and our communities.
For David Zimmer, the debate is too narrow, and that creates the partisan divide that keeps Democrats and Republicans from finding common ground.
One way to ensure everybody is at the table is to make sure you expand the discussion beyond just restricting firearms.
Zimmer is a policy fellow at conservative think tank Center for the American Experiment. He says a special session and calls to ban firearms in the wake of tragedies don't get at the deeper societal problems that lead to mass shootings. While he disagrees with calls for this kind of gun legislation, Zimmer says he understands the rationale behind them. But he can't support new laws that don't also get into issues of mental health.
We have to get into some really meaty subjects, like what is broken in our society.
Ultimately, Zimmer said finding solutions that go beyond policy changes to a wider cultural shift is going to take time.
We didn't get into this problem in a couple of months, and we're not going to get out of it in a couple of months with a special session and passing a couple of new laws.
For North Star Stories, I'm Zan Holston.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Minnesota is facing a blood supply shortage. The amount on hand has dropped below a two-day inventory, according to Memorial Blood Centers. Hospitals normally need at least 7 days' worth to meet patient demand. All blood types are urgently needed, especially O negative and O positive, which are critical in emergencies. The shortage worsened this summer as donations fell during school breaks, vacations, and heat waves, while trauma cases increased. Health officials are urging the public to donate now. Donors can give blood every 56 days or platelets twice a month. Appointments are available online at mbc.org.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Europe is the world's fastest warming continent. Temperatures there are increasing at twice the average global rate. Nowhere is this more visually striking than in the Swiss Alps, where glaciers have lost nearly two-thirds of their ice throughout the past century. As they disappear, NPR's Rob Schmitz reports that Europe's biggest rivers are losing a crucial source of their summer water flow.
Barbara Achreiner sips a latte on a hotel veranda along a busy lakeside boulevard in Lucerne. The hot air over the turquoise water forms a haze that silhouettes the Alps in the distance. Achreiner's moved from hotel to hotel like this one since late May, when she was forced out of her home. She had just begun a job as a manager of the storied Hotel Fafael, perched along a mountainside above the village of Blatten. She and her crew were preparing for their first guests of the season when suddenly her workers started running for the exits.
And they really literally jumped into the car and left. And I was like, what's going on?
On a peak towering over Blatten sits the Birch Glacier. Scientists observing it noticed it was starting to slide down the mountain much faster than it usually does, on a trajectory so dangerous that they persuaded the local government to immediately evacuate the village's 300 people. A week later, the glacier broke loose and came crashing down. Video shot by a local man shows a white cloud of ice, rock, and sand crashing down the steep mountainside across the valley. Achreiner was working in the hotel above the valley when the landslide hit. The lights flickered and went dark. She went outside and hiked to a nearby cliff to see what had happened.
It's beyond imagination. It's something that, you know the village is there, but there is no village. It's just basically a pile of mud and sand and rocks.
The church, town hall, all of the village's homes buried in an instant.
An event of that size is certainly nothing I've seen in Switzerland before, kind of not in the recent past.
Daniel Farinotti is a glaciologist at the public university ETH Zurich.
The $1 million question is, did Blatten happen because of climate change? What we can say is that there were elements in this process chain that may well be related to climate change.
Farinotti and his team at ETH had observed an uptick in rockfall from the glacier for more than a decade. He suspects it was caused by warmer temperatures. He's been studying these changes for years. According to his team at ETH Zurich, glaciers in Switzerland lost half their volume between 1931 and 2016. And now, he says, they're shrinking even more rapidly. Wearing crampons, a harness, and a backpack full of monitoring equipment, Farinotti leads a team of students up the pockmarked dirty ice of the Rhone Glacier, the source of the Rhone River, which flows to France. They carefully leap over crevasses whose icy depths emanate blue light and the echoes of meltwater flowing through a network of cracks and caverns below. As his team erects a pole with a GPS receiver and a solar panel, Farinotti peers at the granite mountainsides looming more than 500 feet high on either side of the ice. In 1850, the glacier was flush with those ridges, he says. In the past decade, though, Farinotti says it's melted much faster.
Where we are standing, we're losing several meters of ice a year, maybe 5-6, kind of in thickness. And then in terms of length, that's typically 2-4%, depending on the year.
And at that rate, says Farinotti,
if we stay on track with the climate we have at the moment, that brings us to a very warm climate, and that would mean that this glacier disappears kind of the late century. So by 2100, you wouldn't find any ice anymore.
Farinotti says glaciers are nature's water towers. The water they've stored for centuries flows down Europe's biggest rivers during the hot and dry summer months, replacing rainwater and snowmelt from the spring. And the Rhone isn't the only river whose source is a glacier. The Rhine, the Danube, the Po, the continent's biggest rivers all start here. And when these glaciers are gone, Farinotti says, these rivers will be forever altered. Hundreds of miles downstream from the Alps, Stefan Bauer leans over the rail of a tugboat to check the river's depth. Here in Duisburg, a port on the lower reaches of the Rhine River, a massive digital sign reads 250 centimeters in big red numbers, a little more than 8 feet.
So the normal water level is, I think it's normally around 3 meters, 3.50 meters, and now we are 1 meter less compared to the normal situation.
Bauer is CEO of HGK Shipping. He says in recent years, the late summer months have meant record low depth levels on the Rhine, the main artery of Germany's economy.
So low water situation was also in the past, it was always there. But the problem is it stands longer. So for a longer period, we are in this situation. So it's now more between 2, 3, up to 4 months, especially in the late summer. And that's then a huge impact.
In the hot, dry summer of 2018, the water level was so low that barges could no longer navigate the river. That spurred Bauer and his engineers to design a fleet of low-water barges that can transport up to 600 tons of goods in just over 3 feet of water. Bauer's team is constructing as many as they can. But in an industry that builds just 100 barges a year, he says it'll take a while to adjust to these new water levels. Back on the Rhone Glacier, glaciologist Daniel Farinotti's team is preparing to test how fast water is flowing off the glacier. They add a visual element to test the water flow, a colored dye. Within seconds of pouring it in, the glacial stream turns bright pink, flowing over a waterfall where the neon cascade disappears into a crevasse. It makes for a good photo, but for Farinotti, the more striking visuals can be seen year to year as the glacier recedes before his eyes.
When we talk climate change, we are talking about 1 degree of warming of global average temperatures. I mean, what does that mean? If you think of heating up your house 1 degree more, I mean, do you feel it? Well, maybe. But if you look at what 1 degree of warming does to a glacier, I mean, there, you know, you don't need to be a scientist to figure out, whoa, that's a big change.
A big change, he says, that will have a cascade of consequences on rivers, on the ecosystem, and on all of us. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, the Rhone Glacier, Switzerland.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Focus Features, presenting Downton Abbey, the grand finale, concluding the story of the Crawley family. This motion picture event can be experienced in theaters this Friday. From the University of Maryland Libraries, home to the NPR archives, dedicated to preserving the history of public broadcasting and serving researchers around the world. More at lib.umd.edu. From Workday, an AI platform to manage HR, finance, and agents that aims to free business leaders from the mundane so they can focus on more meaningful work. Workday, moving business forever forward. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. We receive support from Bemidji Brewing, announcing the release of the new Full Stinger Variety Pack featuring the Blood Orange IPA and Lemon Drop Blonde. Available in liquor stores now. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. The Creative Spirit Fiber Arts Group will hold classes at Willowwood Market, just south of Bemidji, Saturday, September 13th, beginning at 10 a.m. Classes include felted bowls, basket making, Zen rock wrapping, and more. Pre-registration required. Learn more by searching for Willowwood Market on Facebook. Weather tonight, showers likely.